Michael Stipe on stage at Democracy Now!'s 30th anniversary celebration in a rare joint performance, along with the Nationals' Aaron Dessner, Alinda Segarra and Hooray for the Riff Raff, and Patti Smith's bandmates, Tony Shanahan and Jesse Paris Smith. Visit democracynow.org to watch our full anniversary event, including Bruce Springsteen's surprise performance of Streets of Minneapolis. On Saturday, Bruce will perform at the No Kings Rally in St. Paul, Minnesota, along with Joan Baez. She'll be there with Jane Fonda and others. We'll be broadcasting more of our event in the coming days. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Support for KFAI comes from the Cedar Cultural Center, presenting Fantastic Negrito Friday, April 10th. Fantastic Negrito blends Delta blues, soul, funk, and rock across a wide bandwidth to create a fresh sound with throwback roots. He's touring with his latest release, Son of a Broken Man, an album that unleashes his preacher's heart through his blues man voice. Opening the show is Nat Myers. More information about Fantastic Negrito at The Cedar is available at thecedar.org.
Programming on KFAI is supported by the Turf Club, presenting the Flamin' O's live on stage Thursday, April 2nd. The five-piece Twin Cities Ensemble returns to the Turf Club with their new wave rock that has defined them for four decades. Also appearing is Pull String, another Midwest ensemble carving out their nostalgic strand of alt rock. Tickets and more information about the Flamin' O's can be found at first-avenue.com.
All righty, you are listening to 90.3 FM KFAI Fresh Air Community Radio. You are tuned into Tornado Drill, which is weekly programming from 1 p.m. to 2 p.m., showcasing upcoming programmers on this lovely station. We're going to get you all started with a song that we feel like encapsulates programming today, and it is called Love Does Not Equal Pain by the Salt Collective. All righty, welcome back, everybody. This is Musana's Musings on 90.3 FM KFAI, Fresh Air Community Radio. This segment on Tornado Drill is called Diasporic Declarations, and this episode is going to be Community Organizer Reflections on ISIS Siege in Minnesota. Today, I have two amazing guests with me, and I'm going to give them some time to introduce themselves. So we're going to start.
Thank you.
Burhan first.
Thank you, Ash. My name is Burhan Israfil. I grew up here on the West Bank. I've been organizing since I was a teenager, pretty much. And currently, I'm organizing with a group called Cedar Riverside Alliance. We came together during the Metro Surge, trying to provide support and stand with community.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Burhan. And now we're going to turn it over to Fatima.
Thank you, Ash. Hello, everyone. My name is Fadim Mohammed. I use she, her pronouns. I grew up in Southside, Minneapolis, right across the street from Somali Mall. Shout out my people. I've been organizing around housing since I was 16, and I organize currently with New Justice Project around keeping people housed, minimum wage, and the fight against ICE.
Amazing. Thank you both so much. And just so the audience listening knows a little bit about me, I go by the name of Musana's Musings. I am a Minneapolis resident. I've been born and raised in Minnesota, volunteering, always present, and excited to be an archivist of sorts, keeping these conversations alive and making sure that the Twin Cities and the rest of the world gets to know about the Black diaspora stories as we're actively surviving these trying times. So we are going to get started in our conversation. So the first question that I have for you both is, as community organizers, how do you establish trust with the folks you are supporting and advocating for and with? How have you adjusted your approach during ISIS siege in Minneapolis and in Minnesota? And Fatima, we'll have you answer first.
Thank you, Ash. Honestly, I think like as an organizer and as just a community member, like I think it's important to remember that a lot of these communities, immigrants, Black communities, like people are always vying for their time, whether it's politicians who want their vote, nonprofits who want them to enter their program so they can get grant funding, like they are consistently extracted from. So when I'm establishing trust, I like to meet folks where they're at, whether it's they want to organize against like a bad landlord that isn't repairing their unit, or whether it's like getting small business relief, you're a business at the Somali Mall. And I think establishing reciprocity as well, it's like, yeah, what can I do for you because I'm asking for your time? And also, like, how can we work together to, like, contribute to the movement? So, yeah, I think just acknowledging that, like, our communities are extracted from and meeting them with reciprocity and where they're at is how I establish trust.
Amazing. And, Burhan, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Yeah, and, you know, just to piggyback off of that, I think meeting people, you know, like Fatima said, where they're at, you know, responding to their material needs and conditions and allowing them to lead, really. And I think it's, you know, a lot of the times people miss out on just being there, right? Just being involved and feeling like, you know, this also affects you too, right? People don't want to feel like, you know, you're coming in to save the day, so to speak, but, you know, that you're actually there with them and that you're experiencing, you know, whatever that there is they're going through, you know? So I think that's the first step, like, you know, on a grassroots level, just being involved, you know, being on the ground and standing shoulder to shoulder with people.
Of course. Fatima, I wanted to go back to something that you had just said in your first answer. You were saying that our communities are extracted from, and Burhan, I know that you had expounded on that as well. We do know, of course, that ICE has been actively abducting people of all ages within the Black diaspora, of all ethnicities in the Black diaspora, of all sexualities, of all genders, etc., at any point in time. Other than, of course, like abducting our neighbors and our loved ones, like what else has ISIS siege in Minnesota like extracted from the Black diaspora? Or just like taken from us?
Yeah, I mean, I think like a sense of safety, like people don't feel safe in their homes anymore. People don't feel safe to go to work. Like we are seeing like, let me talk closer, I got you. We're seeing that like folks can't pay their rent, folks can't meet their material needs when it comes to food. I know my mother, she was sheltering in place ever since the murder of Renee Good, and like she just popped back outside for Eid, and like ICE is still here. It's not like they have left, and I think they've taken the, like, people's like sense of like belonging and community. And so, and I think Burhan made a really good point of like the most powerful thing you can do is show up and be mm-hmm. consistent. I know a lot of people like feel overwhelmed and they see things on social media, but it's like, just go outside, like talk to your neighbor. Like a lot of folks don't know who their neighbors are, what they're going through day to day. And so, yeah, I think also, and we've lost a lot of trust, like trust in mm-hmm. local government, sometimes trust in each other. You don't know who's calling ICE on who. And so, yeah, a lot of safety. And I'll give it back to you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Burhan, did you want to add anything else?
Yeah, no, I think, you know, just to echo that, you know, anytime that communities have this level of threat and, you know, in dealing with this level of power, it really does fracture relationships mm-hmm. and, you know, people being able to be safe, you know, like Fathom was saying, and being able to trust each other, right? And that goes to, you know, when you talk about some of the mutual aid stuff where people are delivering food, right? Because some people can't come out of their homes, you know, so... I think that's one of the more, you know, that's obviously psychological warfare, right? And it's real, you know? So I think that's one of the big extractions that you're talking about for sure.
Awesome. Thank you both so much. So thinking about, so guys, moving, I think taking this extraction to a different place, but we're still in that same vein. When did you both as community organizers start to notice patterns in how ICE was targeting Black people across the diaspora? How did coordination efforts change in real time to meet community needs? And then a couple follow-up questions that I would like to add that you can all answer like mm-hmm. at any point. Which areas of the Twin Cities or specifically of Minneapolis received perhaps the most support, either from individual neighbors or organizations, whether they be non-for-profit, for-profit, or the government at the state level, the local level? And then did the, yeah, that's what we'll do for now. We'll take those two for now.
I can go if
you yes,
want.
Go for it.
I'm going to answer the first question.
For sure.
I think like we really saw them targeting all up and down Lake Street, Ward 9 and 10 and our cultural corridors. We saw that like that's the week after the murder of Renee Good. We saw them in Ward 4 like using like bioweapons in our Black communities, in our predominantly Black communities. Mm-hmm. And I think they were being bullish. They came in hard in Cedar Riverside, which Burhan can talk more about. But there was pushback. Like, we as organizers had to establish a defense in all these corridors and all these spaces. And this isn't the first time. They came in June on Lake Street last year. And shout out council member Jason Chavez, who, like, warned us, who let us know these things were happening. And so I think it forces us to not only change our tactics, but, like, if you're going to deliver food, like, you might not be able to go to a protest because you don't want your car to get tagged. You need to be strategic and, like, choosing your lane and doing it well. And so, and to be honest, like, we've seen them target Black neighborhoods over and over and over again in the Broadway corridor. The McDonald's security guard, who I'm sure a security guard didn't think he was going to go up against federal goons just to protect the workers who are trying to make that Happy Meal, which, you know, I have my own issues against McDonald's, which I'll keep to myself. But it's like, yeah, they're targeting the most vulnerable of us, and I'll leave it there because I know you have stuff to add, and I think you should really talk about the Cedar Protection Alliance.
Yeah, no, you know, right around the time that we heard about this invasion is when people started to obviously, you know, the conversations and just the level of fear started to go up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at first it's like an emotional reaction of like, man, you know, we can't be sitting ducks, right? We can't be sitting unprepared and having to deal with this over and over again. And so that's where, you know, a group like the Cedar Riverside Alliance showed up, you know, and with support from other, you know, organizers and organizations, where, you know, it's a matter of power, right? Mm-hmm. It's like you're dealing with power, now you have to create your own, mm-hmm. you know, power to defend yourself, to protect yourself. And so that's what, you know, organizations and groups like CRA have been doing, right, since this invasion has taken place. And I think, you know, it really does allow people to feel like, you know, you do have, you know, the capability or the ability to push back, you mm-hmm. know, where you see people who are being, where there's an attempt to abduct them and people come around and they rally around that and they're able to free them, so mm-hmm. to speak, right? And that just allows people to feel like, you know, there is a way, right? There is a, you know, that they do have that level of power within themselves and in their own communities. And I think anytime people organize around not just this reactionary thing, but just being able to like come together and not only provide mutual aid, but just being able to like confront, you know, federal agents and an agency that's it's one of the most powerful ones in the country, obviously. So, you know, I think it just allows people to feel like, you know, that they do have power, right? Without the state's help, without the city's help, right? This, you're talking about actual, you know, individuals and organizers and organizations that are coming together, you know, and literally being in community with people, right? It's care in action, you know, to put it simply. And so, you know, and that's what you've been seeing since, you know, December, I believe, or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping it's something sustainable, honestly, moving forward.
Of course.
Fatima. Yeah, and I think you put it so, like, accurately. It's everyday people in Minneapolis who are holding the line, who are going to rapid responses, who are doing a plethora of different tactics. Like, people have to get vetted before they can sign up for a shift. And this block-by-block strategy, not only was it successful, like, we were able to protect our community, and we went block by block to the point it reached the suburbs, and now we're sharing those tactics with our folks in Greater Minnesota in the suburbs and training them so they can protect themselves. And I think it's also important to, like, really acknowledge that, like, we had a really beautiful infrastructure post George Floyd, and it just grew. Like, Cop Watch came from the Black community. It came from defending your neighbors from state violence. Now it's just federal.
Mm-hmm. Now it's just federal.
And I wanted to add one more thing. Besides, obviously, this federal invasion and ICE, you also had right wing, you know, Nazi invasion too, with you know, YouTube content creators and individuals here coming out of nowhere, right? And specifically here on the West Bank, you know, targeting, you know, Black immigrant communities like the Somalis. And again, you had people that, you know, stood together and were able to create that defense. You know, there was a specific day, January 17th, where, you know, with support from DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America, CRA here, you know, we were able to, like, you know, come together and just, because there was this, you know, angst and fear that he would try to, you know, come marching down to the neighborhood and thankfully he didn't. He didn't make it, you know. Right. He didn't make it out of downtown. So
talk about it.
Yeah, you know, so I think, you know, and again, that's due to people going out of their way to recognize, you know, this sort of, you know, racist, fascist element, you know, that's always been here, right? It's nothing new. It's, you know, it gets amplified here and there, but, you know, it's really an opportunity for people to sort of draw the lines and say, yeah, which side of the fence are you on, right? And so I think, you know, days like January 17th with that Nazi, you know, Jake Lang trying to come here, I think, you know, people made it, you know, clear that, you know, something like that wouldn't be allowed, right? Especially if they allow the people to do what they do, you mm-hmm. know? Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to add that.
Thank you both. For our listeners, far and wide, I think I just want to reiterate, as we're here, as we're talking, the anecdotes that Fatima and Barhan are sharing, all of the abductions that have been happening in Minneapolis, most of them are happening within a 2 to 3 mile radius of one another. Like, mm-hmm. this, I mean, the city is relatively small when we think about Renee. When we think about Renee's death, when we think about Alex Pretty's death, when we think about Jake Lang on January 17th being present, like, any of these moments are happening within 2 to 3 miles of each other at any given point. So we as a population are just taking, like, we are experiencing trauma at a rapid rate, and there's not always a ton of time to recover. So I think to know that that is happening and we're still able to come together is something that I think we should all be really proud of. So to everybody listening, living in Minneapolis, living in St. Paul, living in the suburbs, like, you should be proud. You should love your community members that are there. And for those of us listening, you know, outside of Minnesota, globally, like, if ICE is in your neighborhood, like, you should be proud of yourselves for standing up against ICE as well in these ways. And thank you to our global community for listening and for supporting us. To that end, we know that the media, right, some of our larger conglomerates, i.e., like, let's say, I don't know, maybe like a CNN, maybe a Fox, like some of these ones that we've known for decades at this point, and also some influencers, had taken the time to either come to Minnesota or send some journalists on the ground to capture ISIS siege in Minnesota and how community members are responding, how community organizers are organizing in this way. And so I just wanted to ask the both of you as organizers, how has media suppression and or attention at the national, state, and local levels impacted your ability to support and protect Black people from ICE? And a follow-up question to that is, how has the working relationship between community organizers and independent journalists based in the Twin Cities or based in Minnesota strengthened during ISIS siege in Minneapolis? And Burhan, I'll turn it over to you first.
For me personally, and as an organizer, when you talk about just the for the most part, it's neoliberal media, right? And in the way that they want to somehow maintain the system as it is, but have these little, they try to isolate this moment in history away from this country and and from the system, right? To sort of be like, oh, that's not us, you know? And as long as I can remember, that's always been the narrative, right? Mm-hmm. Like coming in, trying to, again, the whole point is to save America, right? It's to save this empire, it's to save, you know, this country from real accountability as far as what they do to people in general, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, with even with this specific situation, you know, the way they're trying to capture the story, it's almost like, you know, again, they're trying to isolate not only us as a community, but also, like I said, isolating this federal agency as if it's like it's an anomaly, right? And so that's what we saw, right? In the way that they wrote the stories, the way they captured these moments, you know, it wasn't about the fact that, you know, you had communities that were, you know, coming together or, you know, trying to highlight. It was more of a combat, like literally a combative thing almost. Like, you know, it's ICE versus, you know, Cedar Riversiders, ICE versus, you know, the metro area, you know, whatever community that they were trying to capture. And so, for me, you know, the narrative itself just, you know, it just didn't fit me, you know, personally, as far as like, you know, what they could do. And that's, obviously that's where independent journalism comes in, where they are trying to capture, you know, the stories and trying to connect it to a broader struggle and a fight, right, for the rights that the communities have been striving for, right, for decades and hundreds of years here. So, you know, I think that's the difference, right? For mm-hmm. some, it's really about, you know, human rights and rights in general, and some, it's about saving this country.
Real. Fatima, we're going to turn it over to you.
Yeah, honestly, like, when it comes to suppression of media, I not only agree with everything you said, but it's not surprising. We've seen media suppression when it comes to Palestine. We've been seeing when it comes to Palestine. The media decides to report on what's happening there versus on Israel. We've seen it with Flint, Michigan, when they didn't have clean water. Like, we didn't hear about that. We know that national media specifically chooses whose stories gets told and who doesn't. And we're still, like, even though they're not covering ICE, they're not covering things after the murder of Brene Good and Alex Peretti and our national shutdowns, like, we're still feeling the impacts. ICE is still here, and they're not covering what is here and what's still happening. And it's the same thing that happened in 2020. We became a hotbed for all this news. All these people are coming in. They're taking their, like, news clips. They're taking their photos. And honestly, at a certain point, it becomes extractive. And then they leave when the real work begins, when the real relief begins, when we're, in 2020, trying to hold our police accountable, trying to hold our mayor accountable. Now, when, yes, there not might be any as many ICE agents here, but they're still here. It might not be as overt, but it's more clandestine. People are still getting abducted. We still gotta look for people. Yes, those agents left, but I'm still trying to find my neighbor's family. I'm still trying to find cousins. Like, we don't know where they are in Texas. And I think too, especially like, oh, sorry, that was getting to me. Like, our local media is being picked up. You have reporters like Georgia Fort, Chris June, like, who are telling the truth, who are reporting on the real things that are happening. Georgia Fort has continued to report on George Floyd way after everyone left, and she continues to report on the things that are happening with ICE, and now she's facing a federal indictment for telling the truth, and it just shows you that our media is bought for. And now we have our mayor, the same mayor who is refusing to pause evictions for our neighbors who are affected by Metro Surge, who's building a cop city, going on a national press tour, saying he'll be hard on ICE. when I haven't seen him do mutual aid. I haven't seen the city council members who are in his ranks pull the purse strings and like use money from local government. I've seen is them impede progress on a local level. And so, yeah, I'm not surprised at the suppression. And yeah, I'll leave it there and we can talk about local journalists.
Amazing. I think it's also worth noting that ICE agents are, as some of you listeners might have heard, are now moving around in disguise. They are showing up as your local handy people. They're showing up as your Uber or Lyft drivers. They're showing up as contractors to your home. They are pretending to be neighbors that might need help or need assistance. And as soon as you go up to them to try to support them, right, because you are assuming they are who they say they are, they then announce themselves as ICE and then they abduct you. So again, they've also taken the time to infiltrate the school watch groups, among other things. They're pretending to be parents who need children to be picked up to abduct not only adults but also children. So even though there are fewer of them in the state of Minnesota, they are still around. They are still, like, we're still on guard in that way. And we thank our local journalists that are advocating for us day in and day out. Next up, I wanted to know, and I'm sure our listeners also want to too, how you as community organizers respond to comparisons of our community's response to ISIS siege with the overall response to George Floyd's murder and systemic police brutality in 2020. And my follow-up question to that is, did the response to George Floyd's murder and systemic police brutality inform how organizers came together for this moment? So arguably two sides of the same coin. And Fatima, I would like to start with you.
Yes. Honestly, I think the main thing in regards to community response is Minneapolis refused to see their neighbors gunned down, whether it's state police or federal police. And that's the line, point blank, period. And we will shut the city down if we need to, or burn a precinct, because we refuse to have our neighbors murdered. And so with that question, I say, what's the difference? They both patrol our community, these cops, these ICE agents, they murder our neighbors. We have been under police siege for decades. George Floyd, Philando Castile, Amir Locke, Marvin Hayes. I could spend this whole radio show going and going. And if they're not murdering us, they're locking us up. And so I really say, like, the response is pretty similar. Like, Black community started Cop Watch because they knew no one was coming to save them. We're doing rapid response similarly, block by block, because we know our mayor isn't coming to save us. The federal government's the one doing this to us. So we have to take the lessons from the Black and Indigenous folks in this country who have been at the forefront of state and federal violence from the beginning and protect ourselves. And like I said before, one is just state violence and one is federal, and the community continues to hold the line either way.
We continue to hold the line. Burhan, we'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, and in 2020, along that same vein, even here, you know, a lot of people thought that when we started to do mutual aid again and doing, like, you know, literally patrolling the neighborhood to protect the neighborhood, they thought it was from looters. Well, it was honestly from the police, and it was from Nazis. And I think a lot of times when these conversations come up, you know, people tend to think that, you know, it's sort of like, you know, it's the poor versus the poor, right? Or just people without power in general being against each other in these moments. And I think it's just them recognizing the power that they have in being able to organize themselves. And that's what happened, right? And the example I'm giving here on the West Bank, you know, people being able to come together and recognize that, you know, again, the National Guard, you know, whether it's a National Guard or whether it's ICE, whether it's the police themselves, that, you know, it's the community versus them, honestly, right? If there's any them, it's the people, you know, it's those with the acronyms, right? With the FBI, the, you know,
MPD.
Yeah, MPD, you know, UMPD. And so a lot of us, it was a real, like, moment in educating ourselves about where we stood, right? And when that happened with the George Floyd murder and uprising, I think it just gave people a lot more insight about where we stood, right, as a community. and how people are able to come together. And from that, obviously, some people were able to keep that momentum. They continue to organize. You know, they obviously you see with the George Floyd Memorial and all the activities and organizing that happens there, right? To keep community going and to keep people together and essentially to politically educate them, right? And I think, you know, when people, you know, in these moments as they see all this unraveling, I think they recognize, you know, where they stand, right? I think anytime that you get to identify, you know, where what you are and how you show up, I think that's what gives people power, you know, and not just to, like, again, not to dismiss a federal agency as, oh, you know, we rather have our, usual cops and blah. And no, it's, you know, they're all the same. It's all about power. It's all about really being able to, them being able to put their boots on our necks, essentially, mm-hmm. right? Because they all have the same function. It's about control. It's about showing you that you don't have any control, that you don't have any power, and I think, you know, any organizing that takes place for the people, you know, it allows them to get that power back, you know. So.
Oh yes, Faye.
Cool. Yeah, and iconic, by the way. And I agree. Like, I think to answer your question of, like, how has the lessons from George Floyd impacted our response to ICE? It's like we got the lessons from Ferguson. One, to give the credit to them, and then we took those lessons and applied it to George Floyd and the uprising and protecting our people. And now we're applying it to these ICE surges. And again, same vein, protecting our community. And I think people were more ready and willing. I think more people were participating this round because they got that political education that Burhan was talking about from the beginning. And now you have businesses tapping in, like Modern Times. They is a donation-based restaurant. They're not taking money from the community. They're feeding the community for free. Like, even when the murder of Alec Pareti happened, B Resale was housing people from the chemical weapons that was being used on them and ensuring that they could breathe. The most basic thing is just air. And I forgot that beautiful Asian woman's restaurant's name.
Meg Wong?
Yes, Meg Wong. She also did the same thing. And so I think it's really beautiful how the way the community has showed up, and that Minneapolis, we love our neighbors, and we'll, again, like I said, we'll shut it down before we let you take our neighbors. And I'll leave it there because I want to keep it PG. Because I got more to say.
Thank you so much for helping us stay within FCC regulations.
I got you.
Bottom themes that, again, are just coming up from this conversation that I think we should all, as listeners and me as a host, we should just all keep in mind are that they're, like, clearly, like, ISIS presence, right? National media, there's just so many moments that are trying to isolate us, and we have to remind ourselves that we're not alone and that we can come together. And my hope is that this conversation makes you feel like you're connected to us here at KFAI, but also that we all remember that radio is a way that we can all keep connected to each other, not only locally, but also globally. So all of y'all that are, like, logged in on your computers, on the apps, like, thank you so much for keeping this alive. And just knowing that this message can continue to get out, even though there are clearly folks who don't want us to get the message out. So with that in mind, you are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI, 90.3 FM, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at KFAI.org. We are non-commercial, community-powered radio. This is Masana's Musings. You are listening to Tornado Drill, and our segment today is Diasporic Declarations. We do have a couple more questions. Are y'all feeling ready, Fatima Bukhran? Perfect. But before we get to our next set of questions, we do have a message from our sponsors.
South Indian violinist VVS Murari and North Indian shanayist Ashwini Shankar will weave their improvisational musical magic on Saturday, March 28th, 7 p.m. at the Walker West Academy Auditorium, 650 Marshall Avenue in St. Paul. For further information, go to the Indian Music Society of Minnesota, imsom.org. This event, co-sponsored by the Indian Music Society of Minnesota and KFAI Radio, 90.3 Minneapolis and St. Paul, and on the web at kfai.org.
Hey neighbor, West Bank staple and one of the few existing small stages in the area, Acadia Cafe, is asking for community support. On April 1st and 2nd, starting at 8 p.m., join us for music, drink, and song to keep Acadia Cafe going strong. AcadiaCafe.com for more details.
Alrighty, and we are back. You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at KFAI.org and on the KFAI radio app. We are non-commercial, community-powered radio. Before we dive back into diasporic declarations, I, Ms. Hanna's Musings, would love to let you know that KFAI is doing our semi-annual pledge. Please pledge today to keep community radio alive and well. You can give us a call at 612-375-9030. Again, 612-375-9030. Or you can pledge online at www.kfai.org. Again, www.kfai.org. You are tuned into Tornado Drill. And again, Musana's Musings here with Diasporic Declarations. So I am back with my amazing guests, Fatimah and Burhan. And we have our next set of questions. Alrighty. Y'all ready?
Let's do it.
Fantastic. So, how have elected leaders interacted with community organizers during Operation Metro Surge? Some follow-up questions I've got are, have there, in your opinions, been any meaningful or supportive partnerships? And how have you worked alongside elected leaders who are supportive of ICE or question community-based solutions for resident safety and well-being? And then, Fatimah, we'll start with you.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is my bread and butter. I'll be working with these electeds. I'll start with the positives, and then I'll go into the negatives. For positives, shout out my council member, Ward 9, Jason Chavez, and also these folks specifically I'm about to name, like Robin Wansley, Elliot Payne, Omar Fateh, Soren, Jamie Long, Doran Clark. These are the leaders that have been about it, who have continued to show up for community, and they have joined us on the street to do ice watch and patrol our neighborhoods. They have put their bodies on the line, and some of them have had to have interactions with ICE, as well as keeping us informed on what's going on the day-to-day via their social media of where ICE is, if they're in Powderhorn, how many there are, what's going on. And I think when you have a federal government that's coming for you, it really shows you the power between state and local government, a federal and state government. And are there champions on the city council are pushing to give resources back to the community? They gave us $1 million in rental assistance. They're meeting with housing organizers to continue to push this relief. Like, we are pushing for a 60-day release to pause evictions that the mayor is vetoing, which don't even get me started. And trying to get small business relief. They have been on our side and on the side of immigrants and community, and this is not new. We saw this when Chavez was pushing for vendor licenses so that street vendors who are selling fruit don't keep getting ticketed. Because, like, I'm just trying to make money. Like, sometimes I don't speak limited English. Why are you giving me a ticket? And he made a cheap, streamlined process so that immigrants could sell their fruit. And these council members also pushed for the separation ordinance when MPD, back in June, was working with ICE when they did that action on Lake Street, and pushing to have, like, actual protections for our community, while the mayor did and does continue to do nothing. They're the ones that give us real-time updates. And so those are some of the positive ways that we've worked with elected officials at the state level, at the city level. And then, yeah, I'll leave the negative for after. I want to give you some time, Burhan, because I could talk about politics all day.
Yeah, no, for sure. For me personally, just organizing around this moment, you know, some people that definitely stick out, you know, is Omar Fateh, you know, Zainab Mohammed, Senator, Elliot Payne, and Robin, you know, just showing up in community, right? Just showing up, you know, with the organizers and being on the ground. Mahmoud Noor here, who, from what I understand, you know, he was on the ground, you know, taping and just observing, you know, ICE activities in the neighborhood and being able to report on them. And so, yeah, on the positive, you know, side of it, like, people have shown up, you know, elected officials And, you know, and their presence, you know, I think does give some of us, like, you know, some reassurance that, you know, hey, you know, it's at least you're here, right? And you're showing up. So for me, those are the positives, you know, them just being able to show up and be on the ground sometimes.
I would love to just interject a bit and say that, like, that we as the community are all we've got and we are all we need. And it is also important to keep abreast of what is happening in your local elections, in your state elections, because they do have some impact on what is happening in your life. And it takes both the law, but also, like, culturally what is happening, community organizing on the ground, to be able to keep our lives together. So just keeping that in mind.
Can I ask something real quick?
Let's go to Fatima first, and then Burhan will circle back.
I was about to go in on some elected officials. So, do you want to go first, Burhan?
Yeah, let me, just quick. You know, I do think the people who do show up, who are in these powerful positions, I do think for the most part, you know, it's an individual capacity type of thing. Honestly, I think the people who end up showing up, you know, a lot of the times it's because they really care, right? It's not so much that they're representing the office that they're in, but a lot of times it's like some of them have organizing background, right? They are rooted in the community, and so that, to me, I don't even see them as, you know, city officials, like, you know, for some of them at least. And so that's what I wanted to add. Like, some of them I do feel like, you know, especially the ones that have, you know, organizing backgrounds that do show up, you know.
No, I agree with Burhan too. I think, like, especially for those elected officials that show up and continue to show up and use the full powers of their office to get community not only resources but protect them, like, they are connected to their humanity. And I think that's what this is all about, staying connected to your humanity and not letting this numb you, whether it's a federal occupation, whether it's state, like, violence. And so with that, I want to talk about the electeds who haven't shown up. There is a significant amount of council members who haven't done mutual aid. They are unwilling to sign a single piece of legislation or move a single penny to help our neighbors who are under federal occupation. Like, this isn't over. Just because they decreased doesn't mean it's ended. And these folks just continue to align themselves with the mayor and with profit. And they are abandoning the working class. They are abandoning immigrants. They are abandoning people who are not only sustaining this city, but are like the economic power of the city. And a lot of them didn't vote to support the eviction pause. Like, we're just asking you for an extra 60 days to pay rent because people haven't worked since sometimes not till November, because it was happening November, December. Things just picked up in January because, sadly, like, one of our constitutional observers, Renee Good, was murdered. That's when the national media came, but we've been holding it down forever. And instead, these same council members who are not only voting against it, and miraculously due to the good organizing of community organizers, of the city council members that Burhan and I have named that are working with us, it miraculously passed. And then our mayor vetoed it. And now those same council members want to put $40 million into Cop City, in a Cop City that's being built in the heart of Minneapolis, while the Minneapolis heart is still broken. Like, Minneapolis's heart is traumatized, broken. People are reeling from trauma and a federal occupation. And quite frankly, like, half a decade, like 6 years since George Floyd, like, the city hasn't had time to breathe. And we're still under siege. And so I just want to call out those elected officials that haven't. And go look at the vote for the people who didn't vote for pause for evictions. I see you. And specifically Ward 4, because that's my mom's ward. I've been trying to organize that ward forever. And it's like, how are you not helping your community? And so, yeah, shout out those that have showed up. But also, like, very disappointed in the elected officials who are not using their office to protect. Because this is our last line of defense against federal government. And it can't just be on the community's back. Like, we're tired. We're going to keep showing up, but we're tired. And I'm going to leave it there because I get passionate and I can keep going. So I'm going to give it back to you, Ash.
Thank you so much, Fatima. But also, it's the part, like, it's the passion that keeps you going. And it's the passion that, like, it's the passion that we are so excited to be able to witness, bear witness to today. Burhan, do you have anything else you'd like to
add?
All righty. So, of course, as we've been going through this conversation, we've mentioned at multiple points that ICE has not left Minnesota. In fact, ICE is lurking, you know, almost in some ways behind every corner. We know that there are cars that are still being delivered to the Whipple Federal Building. We know that ICE agents are, of course, pretending to be just like us, and then, of course, coming out of their disguise to abduct us. We know that Minnesota residents are still, I get, like, some still sheltering in place. Folks are still being mindful as they're moving about the cities, the suburbs, greater Minnesota, rural Minnesota. With this in mind, how have community organizing efforts in the Twin Cities shifted with the perceived decrease of agents, like in Minneapolis and in St. Paul? How have community organizing efforts in greater Minnesota shifted with the perceived decrease in agents, knowing that actually some of these agents have just left the Twin Cities, but also just gone further out, because they perceive, right, that communities in the suburbs and in rural Minnesota don't have the same capacity that the Twin Cities has to defend itself? And how have organizing efforts expanded to meet the economic, housing, and health needs of Black people during this time? Of course, you all have touched on that, but I think a refresher is great for both me as the host, but also for our audience. And then, Bahran, we'll start with you.
You know, I think one of the biggest lessons in this moment is just like how to create a sustainable effort in general, right? And I think that's the steps that people are taking right now, especially when you get in this news that the numbers are, you know, going down as far as like them being visible and, you know, being out and about trying to snatch people. You know, that allows people to really, again, hone in on, you know, the lessons from this moment, which is, okay, how do we, you know, create a system or some sort of sustainable, you know, line of communication and care, or, you know, for people that are struggling with their bills, that are struggling with food and aid and that sort of thing. You know, and one of the things that I can use it as an example is during this whole Metro Surge effort, we had an incident here in the neighborhood in one of the buildings where it was a flood. The pipes froze and they basically, you know, busted or whatever. And so, you know, that allowed us as, you know, as community members and as organizers with Cedar Riverside Alliance, you know, to provide that mutual aid, like really just come in on an emergency type of, you know, tip and effort. And you know, again, you're talking about young people just taking their time to go to, you know, door to door, right? All the apartments that are affected and talking to the community members and elders and people who are disabled and, you know, everyone obviously is affected, you know, when it comes to that type of emergency. And so that's one of the lessons of like, hey, look, okay, now we have to be ultra hypersensitive to, you know, when things go wrong, they go really wrong for some people, you know what I mean? And so, and their last line of support is, you know, organizers and people from the community, you know. And so that's an example that I could use, you know, within this community specifically. And I know there's many other examples of people being able to, like, literally, you know, amongst themselves, you know, collect, right, rent money and support somebody who's literally about to get evicted, you know, or somebody who doesn't have any food, you know, for that week or whatever, right? And sometimes even helping people, you know, like, you know, people, depend on the line of job, like literally providing transportation so they can go to the job, you know what I mean, make sure they're safe, and then once they're done, they can pick them back up, right? Like literally just going out of their way to do that. And I think that's one of the biggest lessons of like, okay, how do we maintain that you know, that care, right? Something that's sustainable and something that's not, again, you know, where we don't have to stretch ourselves thin, right? Like, how do we create a bigger community, so to speak? But, you
know. Yeah, no, I agree with Burhan. It's all about, like, sustainability and maintaining this level of organizing we've created. And, like, I think to answer your question of how has organizing efforts expanded to meet the economic, housing, and health needs, like, you named a lot of it, like, a lot of folks are raising money for rent. A lot of folks are driving people to work. A lot of folks are like, thank you, Ash. A lot of people are driving folks to work, trying to get things done. But also, like we can't meet the need. Like that's the reality. Like all of our community organizing put together, as long as, like, these are people reaching into their savings, people who are taking out their pensions, people who are, like, I personally know, who are maxing out credit cards just to pay the rent, just to get food, just to get gas, just to not get evicted. Like, one of my good friends did a bar crawl raising $44,000 just to pay someone's rent, and that barely was a drop in the bucket when the Hennepin County is $50 million behind in rental relief. And so what I want to say is that We haven't, we can't meet the need that, that's the fight we're trying to also take to the state and local level. There are not enough resources to meet the need, so we are fighting. You have to understand, a lot of these mutual aid groups are like 6 to 7 weeks old. A lot of them were sprung up out of a response to the ICE surge. And so it's insane to say we are meeting the need when we're barely holding on, and we are holding our breath hoping for some relief from the legislature. They're in session right now. They're talking about allocating a lot of different money, and a lot of us are going there being like, you need to allocate it to us, because these mutual aid groups, we're tapped out, and at the first of every month, we keep trying to find money, but at a certain point, people are going to run out of steam, run out of money, and we're fighting like hell against policies that would make this relief harder. And so that's the one thing I want to say about economic relief. And then the part of your question of like the ICE siege, like, they haven't left. Like, their tactics in the beginning were like bold, incredulous. Like, they were gassing people, they were shooting rebel bullets. It was all about the drama and instilling fear. Let's be so real. And now they're just more clandestine with their abductions, and we're still looking for people. Like, there's people, we don't know where they are. Do you know how wild it is to get taken and your family can't even find you? And so, like, I just, We need help from our local government. We need national solidarity. We need to put an end to this, because this is not sustainable, and we cannot go through this for another 3 years. And they need to get out of Whipple and get out of our state, quite frankly. And yeah, that's all I have to say. Thank you.
ICE out. ICE out.
Get out.
Mm-hmm.
Out. That's just all I have to say, y'all. I just needed to get that off my chest. Ugh. Clear that throat chakra. So, y'all, we've got 6 minutes left of Tornado Drill on 90.3 FM KFAI, Fresh Air Community Radio. I have two more questions for our guests. I'm so thankful for you both for being here today. Our listeners are slowly texting me, are slowly making some notes in our Discord about how thankful they are for the programming. So just wanted to say, I honor you and I thank you.
Thank you, Ash.
Of course. What should people who live outside of Minnesota keep in mind as they learn about community organizing efforts in Minneapolis, in St. Paul, in greater Minnesota, in the suburbs? Pardon me, you can go first.
Oh, you wanna go? Okay. I think in the most simplest terms, just be human, you know? I think we get lost in, you know, living in this world of just, you know, materialism that, you know, and especially the way that it's sort of imposed on us, right? And the values that we have based on individualism and just being selfish about, you know, how things affect you, right? And going back, you know, again, to the fundamental, you know, fact of human life, which is like something that affects me is going to affect you eventually, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that's the lesson in all of this, you know, that it is not just about, you know, the idea that somebody did something wrong, that, you know. And again, you think about real quick about this whole effort and the foundation of it, which is the idea that these are illegal, you know, criminal aliens. And when in their own report, you know, the 90%, something like, or 70 or 80% of the people haven't even committed a real crime, right? So it's the crime of crossing an invisible border, right? So I think just people recognizing that, you know, and saying that, hey, look, man, our humanity comes first, right? Before you drew them imaginary borders, you know, and lines in this world, man, we were humans first, you know, and we need to go back to that.
We are humans first, Fatima. What should people keep in mind?
I want to touch on what you said and that answer. I agree with you. Like, these are imaginary lines that are made up. And also, we live in a country that, like, you invited people here. Like, when my mom was in Somalia doing the lottery, it was the American government being like, pull up. It's like, how are you going to invite we have Hmong immigrants here, current immigrants, like Mexican immigrants. We have people from all over the world. Like, even going all the way back, like the Irish, like, you guys asked people to come here to build infrastructure for your country. You also stole people. You stole land. And so to try to yeet people out of a country you stole and then also invited people to come to, I want to add that. And then for what people should keep in mind, like, I say, like, stay vigilant, stay ready, be careful where you put your money. Like, our enterprises here, we're renting out cars to ICE. Like, the places that you would rent a car out to regularly is out here renting cars for people to be abducted. Like, look into these corporations, because it is the corporations and the ruling class that are funding this federal siege and occupation on Minnesota. And quite frankly, if it can happen here, it can happen anywhere. Like, we are the most educated and civically engaged state in Minnesota. Like, look it up, for real. And we still didn't feel fully prepared. So prepare, get ready. It might not look like this, it might not be as in your face, but it's gonna come to your state. It might look like them being in airports, which they already are. It might look like them pulling up at your polling station, because we know what this is all about, really. Anyway, so I can go on and on, but stay ready so you don't gotta get ready is what I want people to take from this, and protect yourself.
Period. Before we head off air, is there anything else? Are there any organizing efforts that our listeners should be aware of? Any places they should be thinking of supporting?
Yeah, no, definitely support all of the organizing in each of these communities that's taking place, especially the organizations themselves that, you know, people have come together. And I know here on the West Bank, like I said, you know, I really want to give a shout out to the Sioux Riverside Alliance, DSA, who's been really helpful. Communities United Against Police Brutality, who's taken on, just the sustainable part of this, of trying to help communities, you know, structure a system to protect themselves. So just a shout out to those folks.
Yeah, I would say come to the Somali Mall, please come shop. Our cultural corridors are struggling. Our businesses can't pay their rent. Support Neighbors United. It's a group of Somali Mall business owners that are trying, that have a petition, that are not only trying to get some rent, a small business relief, but also trying to, like, get ICE out. I'm not gonna lie, y'all, things are really bad. Like, it just happened, but people don't got enough money to pay their rent, and the landlord is locking them out of their stores. And so please come support the Somali Mall and follow Neighbors United. PSL, New Justice Project, are supporting that. And then for my Black folks specifically, we do a thing at New Justice Project called Black Mast, where we bring folks from across the diaspora. So just educate ourselves and talk about the moment and prepare. And so if you have time, pull up. It's on our Instagram. And then my last plug, this is selfish, this is my body of work. I'm working on $25 an hour because they ain't paying it enough. 16 an hour.